Now, Haynes was mayor of Birmingham, became a CIA contract agent as a result of his work with the B-26 pilots for the Bay of Pigs. He also was a former FBI agent. He also represented, along with his son, some Ku Klux Klansmen who were convicted in the brutal bombing of the 16th Street Baptist Church in Birmingham, in which four girls were killed. Several Klansmen were convicted in that case, despite the fact that they were represented by Haynes. And we also looked at the fact that Haynes was the lawyer for James Earl Ray, the convicted assassin of Martin Luther King Jr. Of course, James Earl Ray, as we looked at, did not kill Martin Luther King. He was handled, much like Lee Harvey Oswald was, in such a way as to make it appear that he was the patsy, the assassin, rather. In fact, he was a patsy. Now, Mayor Arthur Haynes, with his CIA and FBI connections and far right-wing outlook, was one of the people who represented James Earl Ray. We've looked at a couple of the other people who represented him. National States Rights Party head J.B. Stoner, a fellow named Mark Lane, who not only received a lot of publicity in connection with the Kennedy assassination, but later with Jonestown, and eventually Mark Lane went on to work full-time for the Liberty Lobby, a far right-wing and explicitly anti-Semitic organization in this country. And recall also that we looked at another one of the lawyers of James Earl Ray, in addition to Arthur Haynes, CIA man, FBI man, mayor of Birmingham, Alabama, protector of Ku Klux Klansmen. We also looked at a fellow named Percy Foreman, F-O-R-E-M-A-N. Now, Percy Foreman was a lawyer for the Hunt family. He was also, at one point, a lawyer who represented Jack Ruby. Now, we looked at Foreman also in our Radio Free America program about the assassination of Martin Luther King. And specifically, we looked at how Percy Foreman not only represented represented Ruby before he represented James Earl Ray, but also how eventually he represented Ray and eventually went on to work for the Hunts. Now, the Hunts, of course, are pivotally involved in all of the assassinations. Well, they're very much involved in the assassination of John Kennedy, as we looked at. And we're also going to look at Arthur Haynes coming up in connection with another scam that we've looked at in the past. Now, in our last broadcast, we took a look at the Hunt family, and specifically at a man named Paul Rothermeil, R-O-T-H-E-R-M-E-I-L, a former FBI man working as a security man for the Hunts. Now, Rothermeil blew the lid on an organization called the American Volunteer Groups. It's the same name that was used by General Claire Chennault's group, the Flying Tigers, in China. And we're going to look at that some more later. Some of the organizations that grew out of General Claire Chennault, and his Flying Tiger group. Recall that Birch, the original John Birch, was the intelligence advisor and translator for Claire Chennault. Now, we're going to review some of the material here about the American Volunteer Groups, and this comes from a book called Spooks, subtitled The Haunting of America, The Private Use of Secret Agents. That was authored by Jim Hogan, H-O-U-G-A-N, published in hardcover by William Morrow and Company and copyright 1978. I'm going to review the Rothermeil material here by way of getting back to Percy Foreman and some interesting connections here. Recall, Percy Foreman, just like Arthur Haynes of the Committee to Preserve the Monroe Doctrine, one of James Earl Ray's lawyers. And again, before James Earl Ray, I sort of bollocks that up earlier, Percy Foreman represented Jack Ruby. Okay, first a Ruby lawyer, then a Ray lawyer, and eventually a Hunt associate here, as we're going to look at. Reading from Spooks. Working for the very wealthy can be hazardous to your health, however, as former FBI agent Paul Rothermeil claims to have discovered. In conversations with reporter Peter Noyes and subsequently with myself, Rothermeil described his peculiar past association with the fabulously wealthy Hunt family of Texas. While employed in the secret service of the patriarch, H.L. Hunt, Rothermeil said that the old man's son, Nelson Bunker Hunt, approached him in connection with a plan to form a paramilitary group for political purposes, a killer force that would train on desert estates in the West. A connoisseur of racehorses and right-wing causes alike, Nelson Bunker Hunt is an important contributor to the John Birch Society and a confidant of its maximum leader, Robert Welch. He is also one of the world's richest men, having at one time held title to all the oil in Libya. According to Rothermeil, however, Hunt was not content with mere riches and therefore organized the so-called American Volunteer Group, the AVG, organized it, that is, with supposedly lethal intent. Recounting the story, the former G-man contends that Hunt planned to recruit his private army from the ranks of General Edwin Walker's Birch Society cell in Dallas. The weapon of choice, Rothermeil claimed, was to be a type of gas gun imported from Europe, a weapon whose singular virtue was that its victims would appear to have died of heart attacks. Asked to join the paramilitary unit in a war on liberals and the left, Rothermile says he refused. It was then that he found his telephone had been tapped by other spooks in Hunt's employ and began to fear for his life. Okay, so a couple of elements to review here from our last broadcast. American volunteer groups not only affiliate not only the original name of Claire Chennault's group, but also an ad hoc assassination organization allegedly put together or to be put together from General Edwin Walker's Birch Society cell in Dallas. Of course, we've looked at the connections between the Birch Society and the China Lobby and General Edwin Walker in particular in the past. And in the footnote to this particular passage, there's an interesting note here. Hunt, they're referring to Nelson Bunker Hunt. Hunt subsequently pleaded guilty to a misdemeanor stemming from a massive wiretapping conspiracy in which he'd hired a Houston detective agency to eavesdrop on his own security force, a force composed largely of former FBI agents. According to Hunt, he was concerned about an embezzling plot directed against his late father, H.L. Hunt. All of that, by the way, review from our last program. The reason we bring that up at this point is to take note of another figure who was eventually indicted along with Nelson Bunker Hunt, and again, this is the person that we're going to focus on primarily this evening, or for our present purposes. Going to deal now with a book called Government by Gunplay, subtitled Assassination Conspiracy Theories from Dallas to Today. That was co-authored by Sid Blumenthal and Harvey Yazijian, Y-A-Z-I-J-I-A-N, published in hardcover by Signet Books, New American Library, copyright 1976. And in an essay that we dealt with during our Radio Free America show about the assassination of Martin Luther King, an essay called The Assassination of Martin Luther King by Jeff Cohen, we find the following passage. Again, referring to Percy Forman here and remembering the suit brought by Paul Rothermile in connection with, the criminal charges, rather, filed by in connection with the wiretapping of Paul Rothermile. Cohen writes, in 1975, Forman was indicted along with the oil-rich Hunt Brothers of Dallas for conspiracy to obstruct justice in the case of two Hunt-employed wiretappers who Forman allegedly supplied with hush money and pressured to go quietly to jail. So Percy Forman was also involved with covering up the American volunteer groups and wiretapping the people who had helped to break that story. He, previously had represented James Earl Ray and Jack Ruby, works for the Hunts, and another Ray lawyer, Arthur Haynes, connected to Klan, connected to FBI, connected to CIA, also on the Committee to Preserve the Monroe Doctrine. Moving down the list, and again, this is only some of the significant names on the list, down in the P section we find Mr. J. Howard Pugh of the Philadelphia Pugh family. They're affiliated with, their main corporate interest is Sun Oil, and the Pughs are prominent financiers of the far right. And right under J. Howard Pugh we find Mr. A. Felix DuPont Jr. Of course, that is a member of the famous DuPont family of the Morgan Group, and their connections to not only Nazi Germany and the financing of fascism in this country, but specifically the Morgan Group's relations to Douglas MacArthur we covered in our first program. Down in the S section, we find a name that is unfamiliar to us so far, and we're going to be dealing with some more in the future. Professor Hans F. Senholz, S-E-N-N-H-O-L-Z, and Nip's going to tell you about him.
Okay, and the small segment we're going to read is from Danger on the Right by Arnold Forster and Benjamin R. Epstein. It's a Random House book, copyright 1964, and it says, articles by Birchers, John Birch Society people, also appear in Human Events. That's the name of the magazine, Human Events. A frequent contributor is Professor Hans Senholz, S-E-N-N-H-O-L-Z, an ex-Luftwaffe pilot who heads the economics department at Grove City, Pennsylvania College, an institution heavily endowed by the Pugh family. And, of course, that's the Sun Oil Pugh family Dave just mentioned. Senholz is listed as a contributing editor of Robert Welch's American Opinion magazine, where his extreme laissez-faire economic viewpoints frequently appear.
Okay, so one of the things about Senholz, not only a former Luftwaffe pilot, and recall one of the images that we introduced in our last broadcast is that of a tuning fork or a wishbone. You can think of fascism in Germany and fascism in America as being part of two prongs of the same organization. And again, we looked at that some in our first Radio Free America show about the Aryan Nations. That was front and center in our first two Radio Free America shows about the hidden history of the Cold War, and of course also in Uncle Sam and the Swastika, American Industrial Connections to Nazi Germany. But Hans Senholz, not only a Luftwaffe pilot working here with the Committee to Preserve the Monroe Doctrine, doctrine, but is also very much involved with Western Goals, a far right-wing think tank that we've looked at in the past. And it's worth noting, too, that Western Goals, one of its prime movers for a long time until his death in the downing of Korean Airlines Flight 007, was Larry McDonald. Larry McDonald, a former congressman from Georgia, is also a prominent member of the John Birch Society and mentioned also in our Radio Free America show number 8 as being involved with a drugs and gun smuggling ring, which is linked, according to a man named Robert Byron Watson, who submitted an affidavit to that effect, to the assassination of Martin Luther King. So Senholtz, front and center here in the Committee to Preserve the Monroe Doctrine. Proceeding through the S section, we notice General George E. Stratemeyer. Now, George E. Stratemeyer is also a MacArthur staffer. He was an air general, initially an Army Air Force general, and then went on when the Air Force was made a separate branch. But it's worth noting here that Stratemeyer is very, very close to very close to Douglas MacArthur and part of the MacArthur group. That information contained in the Years of MacArthur, Volume 3, from covering the period of 1945 to 64, by D. Clayton James. This is published, Volume 3, that is, of the Years of MacArthur, published in hardcover by Houghton Mifflin, copyright 1985. And very briefly, testifying to the Stratemeyer-MacArthur relationship, Clayton James writes as follows. Another group of six individuals who might be regarded as forming a second echelon of the MacArthur inner group by 1950 were, one, Lieutenant General George E. Stratemeyer, a distinguished leader of the China-Burma Air War of 1943-5, who now commanded the Far East Air Forces. We'll tell you about some more members of that group in the in weeks to come, but suffice it for our purposes right here that Stratemeyer is a key MacArthur staffer. And moving down to the W's, we find a couple of interesting listings here. General Albert C. Wiedemeyer. Of course, Wiedemeyer was front and center in our Aryan Nations Part 2, Radio Free America number 11. He was the military advisor to Chiang Kai-shek and has all kinds of interesting connections. A very, very powerful man, connections with fascists running from the period just before World War II up through the early 60s when we saw Wiedemeyer, along with General Willoughby, nay Wiedenbach, pushing to have the Greater German Reich that many recidivist Nazi elements in Germany wanted. That Greater Reich, by the way, that Wiedemeyer and Willoughby were willing to lend their support to, would have included the cities of Warsaw and Prague. So that was indeed a Greater Germany. And moving down to the W's, the last listing that we're going to talk about here is General Robert E. Wood. Now, Robert E. Wood was the head and founder of America First, an explicitly pro-Nazi organization, and that organization was supportive of Douglas MacArthur, and General Robert E. Wood himself, as we saw in our last broadcast, a very close personal friend and supporter of Douglas MacArthur. So the point, again, the reason we went through that whole list, well, we didn't go through the whole list, but some of those names is to show, it's by way of illustrating the kind of influence that the John Birch Society, which is generally dismissed as a sort of a fringe lunatic organization, this is by way of showing the kinds of people that it could muster under its banner. And it's much more powerful than its nominal membership would indicate. And again, consider how many of these people crop up in connection with the assassination of President Kennedy or the subsequent assassinations or the Reagan administration. And again, we ask you to consider the John Birch Society as the real Nazi Party, as the real vehicle for introducing the military into civilian life.
Okay, we're going to take a short break for a few minutes, and then we're going to be back and on to the next strand of this particular web and begin linking some of these things directly into some actual physical political happenstances that most of you out there will be familiar with and begin to make the pattern even clearer if it's not hideously clear enough already. So don't go away. We will be taking a break for just a few minutes, and then we will be back with more of Radio Free America and Aryan Nations Part 3 with Dave Emery and myself, Nip Tuck, right here on in the studios at KFJC on this Thursday, the 24th of October. And thank you for being with us. We're going to be here until 11 o'clock tonight, and I have a sneaking suspicion that we will not have time for telephone calls tonight, so we will let you know that in advance. And those of you who would otherwise be waiting for phone calls, you can go ahead and plug your tape decks in if you want to and just record this stuff. We do suggest you do that because, of course, we find a lot of this kind of stuff recurs in other discussions that we have on One Step Beyond and comes up in material related to Mae Russell's programs, and it's handy stuff to have. Besides, at least that way, when the 1,000-pound, 1,000-ton refuse hammer, to euphemize Hunter S. Thompson, comes down, at least you'll know why. At least that's a small, a very small good feeling to have at that time, but at least it's some kind of good feeling. Anyway, we have now basically filled you in great depth on what we had been talking about the first two broadcasts, and have brought you back up to date again with some of the thesis statement that we have been developing over those two broadcasts and this broadcast, namely, as Dave so well put it at the end of the last segment tonight, the fact that these are not just nuts that we're dealing with. These are people like William S. Buckley, Lev Dobryansky, who was until very recently Reagan's ambassador to the Bahamas, Albert Wiedemeyer, who was the architect of a large part of the military intelligence policy in China at the end of World War II, and a lot of influential people from MacArthur's staff, all of them related to the John Birch Society. And we will see later that these groups, in fact, come together in a variety of rather bizarre coalitions, but all of them leading to one thing, that is the illicit manipulation of political power in a nominally democratic country.
Now, one of the things we're going to be looking at now, we've taken a look at how the MacArthur Group basically branched off into the China lobby, and how the two of them in turn coalesced with the John Birch Society, with our intelligence services and military to be involved with, among other things, the assassination of President Kennedy. Now, we're going to be looking at a further development of this same nexus. Namely, we're going to look at how the Cuba lobby grew out of the China lobby. Okay, and that's going to be front and center in our broadcast tonight, and the part of it, I should say, that we're going to deal with right now. And also, again, the World Anti-Communist League is very important here, and that's something we're going to be dealing with for our next several Radio Free America broadcasts. Also worth noting that the involvement of the government and the intelligence services in the narcotics traffic is going to begin cropping up here. That's something that we're going to deal with at length in future Radio Free America shows. We're not going to be able to do justice to it during the context of the next few programs, but that's coming up. That's on the burner, so to speak.
Okay, the section we're going to read is from the book The Great Heroin Coup, subtitled Drugs, Intelligence, and International Fascism. It's by Henrik Kruger, a Dutch journalist, translated by Jerry Meldon. It was published by South End Press, copyright 1980. Excellent book, available only, as far as I know, in paperback. Well worth getting your hands on, and one that we have found invaluable in this broadcast. And everybody that I know, even people who are not too sort of politically involved or not too well informed on the substrata of politics, have found this to be a fascinating and quite convincing book because of the real strength of its documentation. Anyway, again, we're talking once again about the idea of how these various groups were used to infuse the military into the political life of the country, and how thereafter they rapidly began to make themselves felt. Again, reading from Kruger's The Great Heroin Coup. In 1953 to 54, the CIA drew on old China hands with exposure to KMT traffic, Kuomintang traffic, Chenault, Willauer, William Pauley, Howard Hunt, and Pauley we'll also be talking about some more, Pauley, and Howard Hunt, of course, you know, and Chenault, Claire Chenault, the leader of the Flying Tigers, and one of the prime architects, especially through his wife after he died, of America's considerably right-wing attitude during the McCarthy era. Anyway, starting that sentence again, in 53 to 54, the CIA drew on old China hands with exposure to KMT traffic to set up the overthrow of the Arbenz government in Guatemala, an operation which at least contemplated the use of, quote, Puerto Rican and Cuban gangsters, unquote. As part of this operation, we see CIA officer Howard Hunt, a veteran, with his friend Lucien Conein, C-O-N-E-I-N, and Conein's friend Mitch Werbel of OSS Operations in China, under Helliwell, helping in 1954 to set up what would eventually become the Latin American branch of the Kuomintang-backed World Anti-Communist League. And as an insert, we know that also as a WACL. We refer to it sometimes by the initials. 4 years later, it says in parentheses, the chairman of this group was the Guatemalan attorney of New Orleans mafia leader Carlos Marcello. Again, inserting Carlos Marcello, a key player in many aspects of the Kennedy assassination.
That's also something we're going to come back to later in the program.
Nevertheless, in the late 1950s, it seemed unlikely that the heroin connection, outside of countries directly involved, like Laos, would either have a major impact on U.S. policy or become a significant alternative to it. With the decline of Cold War paranoia, events seemed to be moving towards normalization. All this changed with the 1960s, when the CIA reassembled for the Bay of Pigs the old Guatemala team, including Hunt, Willauer, and Pauley. who oversaw Cuban recruitment. With the failure of the Bay of Pigs, Cuba became to America what Algeria had been to France.
Okay, now what we're going to be looking at now is, again, we've perhaps for some people strayed a little bit too far from the Aryan nations per se to make this, it seems a little bit obscure at this point. What we're now going to be doing is taking a look at the paramilitary milieu and its development, of which the Aryan nations are an integral part. We've looked at the history of how the various routes which were to result in the Aryan nations developed out of the Dudley Pelly, L.K. Smith, MacArthur Axis, and so forth. Now we're going to be taking a look at what really is the formation of an American Freikorps. Now recall, in the first program about the Aryan nations, we took a look at the original Freikorps, which was an underground extension of the German army put together initially for the purpose of suppressing the communist revolution in Germany. It was then kept together and utilized by the German general staff for systematically assassinating all of the democratic leaders of the Weimar Republic. This not only paved the way for Hitler's rise to power, but specifically the German Nazi Party, in its inception, a front for German military intelligence, basically grew directly out of the Freikorps and the Black Reichswehr, which controlled it, the underground German army. Now, when Fidel Castro came to power in Cuba, initially with U.S. help, and then he turned out to be a Marxist socialist, the United States, of course, reacted predictably negatively and then undertook to overthrow Castro. Now, specifically, the important thing that we're going to be looking at here is the formation, basically, of a whole paramilitary substratum of American society, which was concocted ostensibly for the purpose of overthrowing Castro, which it did not do. We did, however, this group did eventually play a prominent role in the overthrow of the United States government, and that's what we're going to be looking at now, how the Cuba lobby, in essence sort of an American Freikorps, drawn up by the military and intelligence services initially for fighting Castro. We're going to take a look at how this American Freikorps came to be used against the United States, and specifically how the Aryan Nations people grow out of this. Talking about the Bay of Pigs again, from The Great Heroin Coup by Henrik Krüger. Never before had there existed a more remarkable, fanatical group of conspirators than that assembled to create, finance, and train the Bay of Pigs invasion force. Recall the additional discussion about Bay of Pigs in Guns of November number 1. The top CIA figures were Lansdale protege Napoleon Valeriano, that refers to Colonel Edward Lansdale there, the mysterious Frank Bender, and E. Howard Hunt, who was himself involved in at least one of the attempts on Fidel Castro's life. They were supported by a small army of CIA operatives from four of its Miami cover firms. Runner-up to Hunt for the most intriguing CIA conspirator award is Bender, B-E-N-D-E-R, first name Frank, a German refugee whose true identity remains a matter of speculation. Some contend that he had been an agent of the West German Galen espionage network under the name Drecker, D-R-E-C-H-E-R. Others contend it was Droller, D-R-O-L-L-E-R. The former security chief for Dominican Republic dictator Rafael Trujillo claims that Bender was in fact one Fritz Svend, S-W-E-N-D, a Galen collaborator and leader of ex-Nazis in Peru. Prior to the Bay of Pigs invasion, Svend, who was allegedly the CIA's man in the Dominican Republic as Don Frederico, there he purportedly planned the invasion along with mobster Frank Costello and ex-Cuban dictator Batista. So apparently one of the main planners in this Bay of Pigs paramilitary milieu, this Cuban Freikorps, as it were, is a former Galen agent.
And, of course, the man here that Krüger is referring to, if in fact Bender was Fritz, or otherwise known as Freddy Svend, which we know the spelling to be S-C-H-W-E-N-D more commonly, also has turned up, of course, as many regular listeners know, in many recent One Step Beyonds, because Freddy Svend was a prominent friend of Klaus Barbie, among others, and Licio Gelli, and prominently involved in the rat line that took SS men, ex-Nazis, with the help of the CIA and the Catholic Church out of Europe and into South and Central America. So the contacts between the United States and people like Freddy Svend go back a long ways, and the results we're going to be talking about as we go along.
And obviously it's kind of hard with the mountain of information we're giving you at one time here to keep a particular name in a front and center, but do remember Frederick Schmidt and the information Nip just mentioned, because it's an important consideration, and we're going to be coming back to him in connection with the Vatican in a big way. Proceeding here with Krüger's narrative from the Great Heroin Coup. Of the Bay of Pigs, he says, the invasion's moral and financial supporters included many leading China lobbyists. Most important was the multimillionaire behind Claire Chennault's Flying Tigers, William Pawley, P-A-W-L-E-Y. By the way, don't confuse Patrick Frawley with William Pauley. Okay, two different people here. Pauley had been involved in the CIA's 1954 overthrow of Guatemala's democratically elected Arbenz regime. Like Lansky and Traficante, Pauley had had a big stake in Cuba. Prior to Castro's takeover, he had owned the Havana bus system and sugar refineries. He met with President Eisenhower several times in 1959 to persuade the president to assist Cuban exiles in overthrowing Castro. Pauley then helped the CIA recruit anti-Castro Cubans. So, William Pauley, a key member of the China lobby and, again, a backer of Claire Chennault's Flying Tigers, and recall the geniture of John Birch with the Chennault's Flying Tigers, or American Volunteer Group, as it was known, and the relationship between the China lobby and the Birch Society and the new American Volunteer Group of the Hunt family. Remember the, how the this Cuba lobby and this Cuban paramilitary milieu, this Cuban Fry Corps, grows up in connection with and out of the China lobby, which, again, as Kruger had mentioned, had been assembled in 1954 to overthrow the Arbenz regime. Continuing with Kruger's account and skipping down a little further. Speaking here of Santos Traficante, a Cuban mafia capo and a key member not only of the CIA organized crime connections, but also of the drug traffic that's so very much a part of that and that we're going to be talking about in future broadcasts. Of Santos Traficante, Kruger writes, one of Traficante's personal CIA contacts for the Bay of Pigs was Frank Fiorini, F-I-O-R-I-N-I, Castro's liquidator of mob casinos, who now preferred the name Frank Sturgis. In late 1960, Sturgis ran the Miami-based International Anti-Communist Brigade, said to be financed by the syndicate. According to Richard Watley, a brigade member hired for the invasion, quote, Traficante would order Sturgis to move his men and he'd do it. Our ultimate conclusion was that Traficante was our backer. He was our money man, unquote. Another detail from Sturgis's past is especially interesting in light of Frank Bender's alleged ties to the Galen Organization. For a period in the early 50s, Sturgis was involved in espionage activities in Berlin, serving as a courier between various nations' intelligence agencies, and was thereby inevitably in contact with the Galen network. So recall also that Frank Sturgis was not only involved in the Watergate burglary, as we looked at, but Frank Sturgis, his name crops up in connection with the Kennedy assassination, that covered in Guns of November number 3. We also looked at, in connection with the Guatemalan connection, we took a look at Frank Sturgis and a man named Jack Youngblood, indicated as a possible assassin, in fact, a probable assassin of Martin Luther King. Sturgis and Youngblood combined to spring the man who was eventually to replace Arbenz. He was in prison. Sturgis and Youngblood sprung him. That, again, in our Radio Free America show number 8 for people who'd like to bone up on Sturgis' background.
And again, drawing the web of connection, Frank Sturgis and E. Howard Hunt, of course, were also involved, along with several other veterans of the Bay of Pigs, in what famous political event of the 1970s? Well, if you referred to Watergate, you would be correct. And, of course, the kingpin in Watergate is a man we've already talked about tonight, and we're going to read a little bit about some of his involvement in the Bay of Pigs and other operations, starting right now with a section from the Great Heroin Coup. Richard Nixon also helped plan the Bay of Pigs invasion in 1959, chairing the 5412 group, that's 54/12, a National Security Council subcommittee in charge of covert actions. The vice president pushed for the plan's approval before his 1960 presidential race against John F. Kennedy. According to Howard Hunt, Nixon was the invasion's, quote, secret action officer in the White House. President Eisenhower, who would later plead in ignorance of the plan's extent, assumed it was limited to support for anti-Castro guerrillas in the mountains. When JFK took over the Oval Office, he was presented with a fait accompli. If Eisenhower was really left out in the cold on the plan's magnitude, then William Pauley, P-A-W-L-E-Y, must have been among Nixon's co-conspirators. As mentioned earlier, Pauley talked Eisenhower into arming the anti-communist Cubans. Pauley was and would remain one of Nixon's most ardent supporters. When the invasion proved a bust, Nixon's voice was among the loudest, accusing Kennedy of undermining it by refusing reinforcements. And as we have mentioned, and we don't have time to go back into tonight, there are some grave doubts about the actual circumstances of the Bay of Pigs, which you can hear in the very first part of the Guns of November tapes on the assassination of John F. Kennedy, and you can hear the viewpoint of people like Fletcher Prouty who are actually involved. But again, look at these connections back into the Bay of Pigs invasion. Not only E. Howard Hunt, Frank Sturgis et al., William Pauley, in fact, taking a very important point position in the Bay of Pigs operation alongside Richard Nixon. William Pauley, one of the architects of the China lobby, the mastermind behind the Flying Tigers, if you will have it that way, and himself, as we mentioned earlier, involved with several John Birch Society causes. Richard Nixon, of course, the man who cannot remember where he was on the day John F. Kennedy was assassinated.
Which is interesting, considering he was in the same city as the man who had defeated him for the presidential for the presidency a few years before. Okay, recall now, as we continue with our discussion of the Bay of Pigs, recall that image that Nip and I introduced in the last broadcast of a wishbone or a tuning fork, depending on which way you'd like to take it. Thinking of fascism in Germany and America as a unified entity, sort of joined at the base, but sort of a two-pronged but unified entity. And we're going to see how the forces of German fascism, and particularly those elements of it that were brought back over here at the end of World War II, are to combine with our own intelligence services and military in the formation of what we'll refer to here as the Cuban Freikorps. Again, referring back to the Bay of Pigs and the paramilitary operations undertaken before and after it. Kruger writes in The Great Heroine Coup as follows. Miami is the center of a huge conspiratorial milieu whose personnel wind through the Bay of Pigs, attempts on Castro's life, the JFK murder, and the Great Heroine Coup, and which is now reaching out with a vengeance to Latin America and Europe. To trace the roots of this milieu, we must refer to the immediate aftermath of World War II, when the CIA began its close cooperation with Adolf Hitler's espionage chief Reinhard Gehlen and the Soviet general Andrei Vlasov of Russia's secret anti-communist spy network. Vlasov, V-L-A-S-S-O-V's organization, was absorbed into Gehlen's, which evolved into a European subsidiary of the CIA. U.S. and German agents mingled in Berlin and West Germany, paving the way for inroads into U.S. intelligence by former Nazis, SS agents, and Russian czarists. Headquarters of the CIA Gehlen-Vlasov Combine, staffed in the mid-50s by 4,000 full-time agents, were in Pulak, near Munich. There, Gehlen sang to the tune of More Than One Piper, having remained in touch with the old Nazi hierarchy relocated in Latin America, whose coordinator, Otto Skorzeny, was in Spain. Interjecting here, Skorzeny was a key member of the Gehlen organization. Proceeding, Skorzeny had infiltrated the Spanish intelligence agency, DGS, and effectively controlled it single-handedly. With the onset of the Cold War, Galen's agents were recruited by the CIA for assignments in the United States, Latin America, and Africa. One agent reportedly was Frank Bender, allegedly alias Fritz Svend, a key figure in the Bay of Pigs invasion. U.S. historian Carl Oglesby sees the origin of much of the CIA's later sinister record in the alliances it forged almost immediately upon its birth with the Gehlen-Vlasov organization and, through Operation Underworld, with the Lansky Crime Syndicate. Everything after this, the Gehlen Alliance, and on top of Operation Underworld, was probably just a consequence of this merger. How can a naive, trusting democratic republic give its secrets to crime and its innermost ear to the spirit of Central European fascism and expect not to see its constitution polluted, its traditions abused, and its consciousness of the surrounding world manipulated ultimately out of all realistic shape? I would interrupt here and interject that perhaps that's not quite as surprising as it may seem, considering the tremendous involvement of this naive, trusting democratic republic with Hitler before the war. Proceeding here, Kruger writes, well put. Moreover, it is ironical that Europe's contribution to U.S. fascism is now returning home and threatening the continent in a conspiracy supported by U.S. economic and clandestine forces. The forces Oglesby speaks of were united during and after the Bay of Pigs affair, and their bedfellows were big businessmen with their own private interests. The merger was toasted in Miami. The Bay of Pigs invasion itself was not the most important phase in the development, again referring here to the development of this Cuban Freikorps here, this paramilitary milieu that was all around the Gulf Coast and throughout the Sun Belt. That, referring to the main element in its development, that was CIA station JM Wave and its Operation 40, the agency's secret war on Cuba from the summer of 1961 until the end of 1965. 4 years during which a truly conspiratorial powerhouse was forged in Miami. Station JM Wave was unique in the annals of the CIA, as attested to by then Deputy Director of Intelligence Ray S. Klein. Quote, It was a real anomaly. It was run as if it were in a foreign country, yet most of our agents were in the state of Florida. People just overlooked the fact that it was a domestic operation. With the start of its secret war, the new station became the agency's largest and the command post for its anti-Castro operations worldwide. Its annual budget of $50 to $100 million financed the activities of 300 permanent employees, most of them case officers who controlled an additional several thousand Cuban exile operatives. Each major CIA station had at least one case officer assigned to Cuban operations, who ultimately reported to Miami. In Europe, all Cuban matters were routed through the Frankfurt station, which in turn reported to J.M. Wave. J.M. Wave covered anything and everything Cuban, wherever in the world it might be. So again, recapping some of the important details here. As indicated by Kruger, the most important element in the formation of this Freikorps we're looking at, this paramilitary nexus, which was through all along the Gulf Coast and throughout the Sun Belt, ostensibly to deal with Castro's Cuba. The main element is a thing called J.M. Wave, which is basically a huge CIA covert paramilitary operation operated on United States territory. As Ray Klein indicated, they just sort of forgot about the fact that it was in the United States. And it's worth noting that as a result of J.M. Wave, every CIA station around the world was reporting and contributing to Miami. Okay, this is not in a foreign country. What this is basically is a CIA covert operation come home.
Okay, I'm going to read a little bit more from the Great Heroin Coup, and again, talking about J.M. Wave and some of the ripples from that particular wave. The Bay of Pigs invasion was, of course, a fiasco, Henry Kruger writes, but that hardly stopped the CIA, the syndicate, or their Cuban exile troops. Wheels were soon turning on new assassination attempts under CIA agent William Harvey, who again collaborated with the underworld. Within months, the Miami CIA station J.M. Wave was again in full swing. It sponsored a series of hit-and-run attacks on strategic Cuban targets that spanned 3 years and involved greater manpower and expenditures than the Bay of Pigs invasion itself. To head the J.M. Wave station, the CIA chose one of its up-and-coming agents, the 34-year-old Theodore Shackley, who came direct from Berlin. His closest Cuban exile associates were Joaquin Sangenis and Rolando Watergate Burglary Martinez. Some 300 agents and 4,000 to 6,000 Cuban exile operatives took part in the actions of J.M. Wave. As later revealed, one of its last operations was closed down because one of its aircraft was caught smuggling narcotics into the United States. By the way, just a quick insert. Bear that in mind when the Reagan administration starts talking about Castro and the Nicaraguans shipping heroin into the United States to soften up the underbelly of democracy, that it's the CIA operatives that all along are the ones who have been bringing narcotics in, quite often on CIA time with CIA money at taxpayer expense.
This, by the way, is going to be the focus of a couple of Radio Free America shows in the near future.
Indeed. Going along, Shackley is another contender for the Most Intriguing CIA Conspirator Award. After years of collaboration with Traficante organization Cubans, he and part of his Miami staff were transferred to Laos, where he joined Lucien Conain. They helped organize the CIA's secret Mayo Tribesmen Army, the second such army drummed up by Shackley that was up to its ears in the drug traffic. Vientiane, where Shackley was the station chief, which of course is the capital of Laos, where Shackley was the station chief, became the new center of the heroin trade. Later, he ran the station in Saigon, where the traffic flowed under the profiteering administration of Premier Ngaien Cao Ky. When the agency prepared its coup against the Chilean President Salvador Allende, Shackley was its chief of covert operations in the Western Hemisphere. When William Colby became the director of the CIA in 1973, Shackley took over his job as chief of covert operations in the Far East. Eventually, he was booted out of the agency as part of the shakeup ordered by its current director, Stansfield Turner. In the J.M. Wave period, a great expansion in China lobby, Traficante, Cuban exile, CIA connections occurred. William Pauley, again, P-A-W-L-E-Y, financed a mysterious summer 1963 boat raid against Cuba in his own yacht, the Flying Tiger II. Besides Pauley himself, the crew included a mafioso John Martino, who had operated roulette wheels in one of Traficante's Havana casinos. CIA agents codenamed Rip, Mike, and Ken, the ubiquitous Rolando Martinez, and a dozen other Cuban exiles led by Eddie Bayo and Eduardo Perez, many of whom eventually disappeared mysteriously. Lauren Hall, L-O-R-E-N, Hall, another former Traficante casino employee, claimed that both his boss and Sam Giancana had helped plan the raid. Claire Booth Luce, a queen pin of the China lobby, and of course also the matriarch of the Luce family that brings us Time and Life and all those other great magazines. Claire Booth Luce, a queen pin of the China lobby, testified during Senate hearings on the CIA that she had financed an exile gunboat raid on Cuba after JFK had ordered the agency to halt such raids.
Okay, and remember the name Lauren Hall, too, because he's going to be cropping up in a big way as we examine how the Aryan Nations proper intersects with this paramilitary organization, this paramilitary milieu that we're looking at the development of right now. Recall that in the discussion of the origins of the World Anti-Communist League and in analyzing how the China lobby came to be focused, first of all in Guatemala and later in Cuba, Henry Krueger spoke of an interesting fact which we're going to take up in detail here, namely the fact that the president of what eventually was to be the Latin American affiliate of the World Anti-Communist League was none other than a former attorney, at that time the active attorney for New Orleans capo mafioso Carlos Marcello, also involved in the Kennedy assassination as we looked at in Guns of November number 1. Okay. Now, the interesting thing about this is that the World Anti-Communist League is something which is very much on the scene today. We're going to be talking about that in our next broadcast at great length and in a little bit in the broadcast tonight. But it's worth noting that the World Anti-Communist League was really a consolidation of pre-existing organizations. It formally came into being in late 1966, but it actually was in existence in the form of a number of pre-existing organizations before that. What happened in 66 is they became formally associated and titled, whereas previously the association had been informal and the groups did not have a unified title. But the World Anti-Communist League in particular has cropped up in connection with the discussion of Latin American death squads in a series of Jack Anderson columns, and we're going to be talking about that also in a future Radio Free America. Going back to the Marcello connection here, specifically one of his attorneys becomes president of what was to become the Latin American affiliate of WACL. Interesting discussion about that is contained in a book called Crime and Cover-Up, subtitled The CIA, the Mafia, and the Dallas Watergate Connection, that was authored by University of California at Berkeley professor Peter Dale Scott, whose work we dealt with just a few minutes ago. This book was copyrighted in 1977 and published by the Westworks Publishers of Berkeley. And of the future, or the World Anti-Communist League affiliate to be of Latin America, and its development and its president, an attorney for Carlos Marcello, Scott writes as follows. The CIA had long used the Mafia's corrupt influence in Caribbean dictatorships as an asset in its own anti-communist arsenal. Thus, the chairman of a 1958 anti-communist conference in Guatemala, of a group organized for the CIA 4 years earlier by E. Howard Hunt, was Antonio Valladares, V-A-L-L-A-D-A-R-E-S, the law partner of the CIA-installed Minister of the Interior and the attorney for New Orleans capo mafioso Carlos Marcello. Valladares once arranged for Marcello's false birth registration in Guatemala. Also present at the 1958 meeting was a New Orleans lawyer, Maurice B. Gatlin, G-A-T-L-I-N, who was also involved in other anti-communist activities at the 544 Camp Street address used by Oswald. Okay, now at this point we're going to stop and review a little bit from our Guns of November number 1 about the 544 Camp Street, 531 Lafayette Place dichotomy here and explain just how it is that people like this could be involved with Lee Harvey Oswald.